I had mentioned, Holly, after your presentation, about this special rapporteur that had gone to the Marshall Islands. And that was a big deal a couple of years ago, but I haven't really heard anything about it since. Has that had any traction? Has it had any effect on getting attention to the issue?
I think anytime you can get the United Nations to pay attention to these issues, it's absolutely fabulous. So without question, yes. I think in the case of the Marshall Islands, where the government had been working with the United States for so long and had that door closed over and over again by members of Congress, so to be able to go to the United Nations and have the United Nations with a special rapporteur really validate a lot of the damages and injuries that hadn't been talked about, and to acknowledge that the U.S. had additional responsibilities was a very important political step. Of course, being the United Nations, there's no requirement there. And so the Marshall Islands can take that to the U.S. and say that, yes, the U.N. believes that you should take greater responsibility, but there's no ability to force that to happen. And so it's a moral victory in some ways. It strengthens the political positions, but it doesn't yet result in any actual outcomes.
This is also for you, Holly. This is from Kevin Blanche, who says that he has AML leukemia. It was given 2 months to live 3 years ago, and he's been in LDS Bone Marrow Transplant Center for 3 years. And says that his father was an atomic lab rat, a Marine, in the Nevada test site, and says that no one talks about this issue of U.S. military personnel. So he's wondering why and if you think there's anything that could be done.
Yeah. Well, I think absolutely the issues are the same, right? The U.S. military, it was often the rank and file who were exposed to the radiation from U.S. testing. And just like the Marshallese, too, not in a position of power to negotiate those outcomes. And so, yes, the U.S. military, who are exposed to radiation by U.S. tests, and also in the Marshall Islands, they experience a lot of the same challenges that the Marshallese did as well. And so I think it's that acknowledgement piece. I think, again, going back to the fact that today is March 1st, and we have the privilege of distance from March 1st, that in the Marshall Islands, it's an enormous event today, but we have the power of that privilege of being distant from the damages that go along with the nuclear weapons testing. So we're in the place that takes all the political and economic and military benefits that have come from the nuclear war, and we're distanced from the everyday reality of those health impacts that last for generations, that last for decades, thinking about the latency of a lot of those emerging cancers, too. And so, again, it's a privilege to be distant from that, and we should be very uncomfortable with that privilege, and we should disrupt that privilege and come to terms with it.
The next question's for Hans, and it's from Hugh. Modernization of the stockpile sounds benign, even desirable. Is there another word that we can use? And I have heard this question before, too, asked to me when we do our modernization report, but it sounds like, ooh, we're getting an upgrade. So if there's another type of language we could use to describe the situation.
I'll leave it to people to figure out a better word, but modernization is what it is, as far as I can see it. But I'm open to any suggestions, of course.
The next one's for John. Does a financial transaction task risk a disproportionate impact on migrants? Perhaps maybe a bit of explanation of how it differs from maybe people moving, money moving. I'm not quite sure.
Well, I don't think, and I could be wrong here, I'm not an economist, but you know, this is a tax that's I think I understand what you mean. It's not a tax on remittances. In other words, people who send money back to their home country, that's not what the tax is on. That's not the financial transactions we're talking about. And I'm sorry, I wasn't clear about that. Basically, a financial transaction is something your stockbroker or somebody else's stockbroker is engaging in. In other words, a sale of a stock, a sale of a bond. It's not remittances. So this would have no impact on migrants or people sending money through cash transfers of that nature. This is strictly And again, the term financial has this particular meaning of what happens in Wall Street. So another way of calling this is a Wall Street tax. And that's why, you might imagine, Wall Street is not that happy about this tax.
Back to Hans, we have a question about the B61 and other modernization programs. Do you think that these increase the likelihood of use of nuclear weapons?
So I mentioned in the briefing, I mentioned the example with the Pakistani development of a short-range rocket, 60-kilometer, that's explicitly intended to be used short of the big exchange, so to speak, and possibly even responds not to a nuclear attack, but a conventional attack. So there's an example of a trend, if you will, of a development where, yes, that potential use seems to be more likely in scenarios. They're certainly envisioning the potential use in a scenario that was not earlier envisioned. So I think that's a very troubling development in that region. And in terms of the B-61, for the military planner, it changes things dramatically because you now can develop, you can now deliver a weapon against the target and hold a target at risk without having to use the high yield you were required to use before. And the nasty thing about high yields is that you get a lot of radioactive fallout. And so to some extent, this is what these guys, the planners, say, there is some self-deterring effect in very high yield weapons because you have to think about where's this stuff going to fall. In the big ultimate scenario, that's not going to matter, you know. But if you're talking about very limited scenarios, it can have an impact. And so for the planner, if they can choose a weapon where we can have the same impact and hold that underground command center or whatever the scenario is at risk with a weapon that produces a fraction of the fallout that you would otherwise have to do, then yes, it is more likely that these advisors would advise that it would be the weapon of choice if the president ever got into that corner. Would it be easier for the president to authorize? That's another matter, it seems to me, because it's more like, do you go nuclear or not? That's still a huge hurdle in and of itself, and thank God. But I think for the planners, yes, they will begin to contemplate new scenarios. They will build new strike options that they can offer to the president so he has credible options, if so and forth. So that's the cycle that always happens. I think it happens at both ends of the spectrum of strike scenarios, if you will. There is one that has to do with the situation in Europe where you will have a weapon after this new one is introduced that can hold at risk targets that cannot currently be held at risk. And so... So in Europe, I think the situation is a little different because, so you get a scenario where you can put a weapon on target and have, you know, capabilities to hold at risk targets you cannot currently hold at risk. Not that we need it, but that's what you can do, and that's how it's going to be read by the other side. Absolutely. The Russians are keenly aware of what's going on, and it's going to feed into their paranoia about, you know, the paranoia they already have about NATO. But it also has an effect on the other side of the scale, at the strategic level, that we currently have a weapon in our arsenal that's the B-83 bomb, which is a monster that has a yield up to 1.2 megaton. And, you know, even in the darkest corner of the nuclear planning community, you'll have people saying, what do we do with a thing like that? Even if you had to use it, it's so dirty. It has lower yield options, but the fact that it goes so high is because it's intended to, you know, dig up underground facilities. So I think for that end of the scale, it would allow a planner to develop a strike option where you can use this weapon that would use a much smaller yield against the target that previously required this very, very high yield. So this raises all sorts of problems about, you know, when do things become more usable? Is building more usable weapons a good thing? Do we want to send that signal to other nuclear weapon states around the world, et cetera? So, I mean, it's this self-feeding, well, I guess you can call it the self-licking ice cream cone here that, you know, it's a system that's feeding itself, and you're building missions that become more credible, more reliable, more feasible, what have you, and the adversaries see that, and it feeds into this whole loop about action-reaction, I think, which is still, unfortunately, and uncomfortably alive in international relations today.
Thank you, Hans. For Holly, you spoke in detail about the human suffering in the Marshall Islands. Could you speak about the environmental damage?
Yeah, so the environmental damage has also been very profound. I think in a country that just has 70 square miles of land, that any destruction of that land has enormous impacts. And in particular, is talking about the indigenous relationships with the land too. When the land also gives you your spiritual connection, it gives you your family lineage, it's the place where you get your resources from. So having land damage does not... it's not the same thing as it would in the Western world. So some of the areas in the Marshall Islands were completely vaporized. There are islands that used to exist and were completely obliterated by the strength of the tests, and they're no longer there. There are other islands that remain so radioactive that people can't return to those islands. For instance, the two Ground Zero locations of Bikini and Eniwetok are still so radioactive and will be for generations to come. So that land remains uninhabitable. The radiation is everywhere. It's in the trees, it's in the plants, it's in the animals, it's in all the resources that the Marshallese need to survive. And so the environment and the health are so closely related. And it's really interesting, too, if we think about Bikini, too, and thinking about the word bikini, and you think that every single person really in the world knows that word bikini and thinking of it as the bathing suit. But for others, for people in the Marshall Islands, that's somebody's sacred homeland. That's homeland that can't be occupied now because there's too much radiation in that land. And that word bikini came from the nuclear weapons testing after World War II, where a French fashion designer was looking for something hot and explosive and new to describe the new events that were going on in the Marshall Islands. So the name bikini is a homeland, and it actually means the skin of a coconut. And it's the place where elders are buried that people can no longer go back and tend to. It's a place that has spiritual significance. It's the ability of the people to take care of their chiefs and their families. All of that is off limits now. We only know the homeland through the name of the bikini bathing suit, but we don't know it as land that people can no longer occupy because of the radiation that remains there. And so, again, thinking about that idea of privilege and becoming uncomfortable, that bikini for us is synonymous with a bathing suit rather than synonymous with somebody's homeland, is problematic. And it shows the silences and the effectiveness of the U.S. government in asserting its power to frame the narratives around what happened in the Marshall Islands and removing the Marshallese people, which is why I very much today wanted to make sure that we had the voices of the Marshallese and we had the faces of the Marshallese so you could see them as well, because we need to, if we're going to be thinking about the impacts of the use of nuclear weapons or nuclear energy, we have to be fully thinking about the human faces and the environment of the people who have been adversely affected by nuclear weapons.
Thank you, Holly. For John, how large a fraction of the United States' carbon footprint is the military responsible for?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I can't give you a number off the top of my head, but I can tell you that, for instance, the Air Force and the Air Force's use of jet fuel is one of the major contributors to not only the amount of fossil fuels we use in the United States, but also carbon emissions. And there was an initiative, and it continues to be an initiative, to address that as the primary aspect of the Pentagon's carbon footprint. But just to provide better fuel, you know, more efficient fuel, of course, my preference would be to get rid of the fuel altogether so that the planes couldn't fly, but that's another issue. So there is an effort within the Pentagon to reduce its footprint. You might also be aware of the huge solar facilities that are set up outside of Air Force bases here in the United States, military installations, so that the Pentagon can be, shall we say, greener, an effort to make a greener Pentagon. And here's the irony. I mean, it's that the Pentagon does have this this initiative to become greener, but you know, but the Pentagon as a complex itself still, even no matter how green it might get, no matter how many solar cells it might put out in the desert next to these Air Force bases, the Pentagon itself is still a major contributor to our carbon footprint. And so one way of dealing with that is not to make the Pentagon greener, but to shrink the Pentagon significantly.
Thanks, John. People like that. For Hans, why do all the nuclear weapon states think that they need to modernize their arsenals right now?
Well, it depends on who you ask. But when you have nuclear weapons and you think that nuclear weapons are important, then those weapons have to be capable of doing what they're designed to do. So that's the loop we're in. And if you're part of the conversation that the U.S. military right now has, or the U.S. nuclear laboratories have about the need for modernization, it's very much about the perception. The spin is that, well, we haven't really done anything on maintaining our nuclear forces for the last two decades, and now it's catching up. And so now we have no choice. We have to do it. And if we don't do it, well, you know, it's going to fall apart. Won't be able to use it, and it's too important for that, and what have you. So it's very much part of the sort of the house maintenance type of explanation right now that's going on. So there's an element about that which is, you know, it's if you have them and you think and you say they're important, you have to maintain them. There's, of course, still another element of it that has to do with, well, when you maintain, you know, how expensive or how cumbersome does that maintenance have to be? Right now, we're in a very, very simplistic mindset in the United States, certainly in the debate that's happening in the Congress, which is basically saying, don't question modernization. We're reinventing or remaking what we have, you know, and if we don't do that, it's going to hit the fan. So I think it's like, you know, it's this gloom, doom, simplistic type. There's not even an attempt to have a conversation about, well, can we do with less? Or instead of modernizing this to that extent, could you modernize it in a simpler way and it would still be good enough for the limited scenario where people can actually envision that nuclear weapons would be required in the real world? So, you know, I'm just saying that there's, you know, a huge span of perspectives going on here, but it's basically down to the bottom line that if you have them and you say they're needed, then you have to maintain them. That's that part of it. But then there's also an element of it that has to do with the state that a lot of countries around the world are in, India, Pakistan, and to some extent China, which is they're not only in a maintenance mode, so to speak. They're in a build-up mode, and they're in an enhancement mode. And so they will introduce and modernize their forces because they need a new system, they say, to do something more. In India, they're building longer-range ballistic missiles that they don't have to be able to engage China across its entire spectrum, its entire territory. I mentioned Pakistan building a tactical weapon that can go in a mission that cannot currently be done with another weapon system. China that's building mobile ICBMs because they're afraid that advanced U.S. targeting capabilities can take out their retaliatory nuclear capability. Therefore, they're putting them on the wheels and sending them around the countryside so they can hide. You know, so there are many different factors that drive this modernization cycle. It depends on what country we're talking about.
For Holly, do the Marshallese have any recompense via the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act?
The compensation is difficult. So the United States set up an alternative judiciary in the Marshall Islands, a nuclear claims tribunal, in response to the people of the Marshall Islands had been coming to the U.S. courts, and the U.S. courts said that, no, that wasn't the proper jurisdiction. And so they set up an alternative court in the Marshall Islands, the Nuclear Claims Tribunal, and the United States put funding for both personal injury and for environmental damage. Well, the personal injuries are so far beyond the amount of money that was allocated that people can't even get the injuries, get the compensation for their personal injuries. I think the figure was like more than 55% of those claims go unawarded because there are inadequate funds that have been provided by the U.S. government. The Marshall Islands government regularly goes to Congress and asks for additional funds to be put into that compensation program, but as yet the U.S. has not been able to do that. There have been environmental awards, land damage awards that have been brought by the community to the Nuclear Claims Tribunal, and the Nuclear Claims Tribunal has gone through its due process and provided and claims to those communities for their land damages, but there's no money to go with it. And so there has been a process where the awards have taken place, but there has not been funding to actually be allocated to the people. In the case of Marshallese workers, we saw a picture before of the dome, that plutonium facility that's on Eniwetok. And so the United States government hired both American workers and Marshallese workers to do the cleanup of those activities. For the U.S. workers, because they were U.S. citizens, they were eligible for health care and compensation if they got ill through those activities. For the Marshallese, because they're not U.S. citizens, those workers who were employed by the U.S. Department of Energy to do the exact same work were not eligible for any compensation or any health care for any of their illnesses as a result of the cleanup. And so, again, we see that immigration status or relationships with the U.S. affect the compensation. So there's been very minimal and grossly inadequate compensation.
For John, a question about the figures on military spending and wondering how complete these numbers are, given that there's often things that aren't included in the military spending budget, such as war debt obligations or NSA spending or even nuclear weapons that aren't necessarily incorporated there. So just wondering how you account for that.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the figures I cited for the ratios, that generally took a kind of conservative baseline for Pentagon spending. So obviously, for instance, for the 2013 figure, it was $575 billion for military spending. Now, as many of you know who have looked at military spending carefully, $575 billion is a pretty conservative figure, and it doesn't include a lot of traditional things we include, including a portion of the debt. If we look at a much larger figure, that would be closer to $1 trillion as opposed to $575 billion. And if we're talking about $1 trillion as a military budget, encompassing all of the many aspects of military spending across Pentagon, Department of Energy, et cetera, Homeland Security, intelligence services, that $1 trillion budget would, of course, widen the ratio considerably, make it look even worse for the United States in terms of how much we spend on the military and how much we spend on the climate change. But these are the figures my colleague at IPS uses, so I use her figures for these comparisons.
For Hans, a question about where modernization or by whom modernization is being funded, if there's corporations involved, particularly in the United States.
Sorry.
Like corporate involvement in modernization programs.
You mean what are the companies that are involved in the modernization program?
Right.
Well, that's a long list. Lockheed Martin is on the top, no doubt about it. Oh, yeah. The report, Don't Bank on the Bomb, it has a long table.
And we'll have a presentation, actually, from one of the authors in the next session. So.
But it's a long list, and it's a list with enormous players in it. I mean, you know, Lockheed Martin is a monster. I mean, it's at the level where, you know, its budget is basically more than most countries in the world. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So anyway, but that's just to say that, you know, the tail kit, for example, that's been developed for the B-61-12, that's Boeing doing that with Air Force funding. You know, the labs, of course, are doing their thing. We have, so Lockheed Martin is doing the F-35, is doing the Trident. The developed Newport News Shipbuilding will be, you know, developing the next ballistic missile submarine and building it. What else we have? Grumman building some of the bombers. I mean, it's just a long list of companies, but look in that table. It's pretty comprehensive.
Great, thank you. And yes, as I said, there will be a presentation on that in the next session to go into that more in depth. Okay, back to John. The Department of Defense has been experimenting with methods to change and manipulate the climate for military purposes. So just wondering if you have any thoughts on moral or financial aspects of that.
Yeah, well, of course, that is the kind of addressing climate change that we don't want to see. For instance, geoengineering, which some of you have perhaps heard about, an effort to effectively change the climate through manipulations, injecting things into the atmosphere, into the ocean. And the Pentagon, of course, is looking into this as well. Financially, it would be a terrible thing, of course, if we were to shift money from military spending into addressing climate change, and that, frankly, was only shifting resources within the Pentagon from addressing military hard security questions to addressing climate change issues through such processes as geoengineering. So financially, that would be disastrous. And then, of course, morally, it would not be good either. You know, effectively, you know, the notion that climate change, that the Pentagon should be the lead institution in addressing climate change in American society is pernicious and something we should avoid as much as possible. Of course, it's not just the Pentagon. Other military institutions in other countries are interested in this as well. We should avoid the militarization of the climate change question in general. This should be an issue that's addressed by climate scientists, by environmental agencies, not exclusively, but primarily.
There's one here for me that is just wondering if I could repeat the website name for where you can find presentations from the Vienna conference and other such conferences. So that's reachingcriticalwill.org. Which is the program that I work for. It's a program of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. So it's just reachingcriticalwill.org. We have time for one last question before breaking for the coffee. So this one's to Hans. It's wondering about sort of the launch status of nuclear weapon forces and wondering how aware the U.S. population is about these the status, and also what could be done to get the president to take any kind of action on it?
So, you know, the launch status of nuclear weapons, if you look at the different nuclear weapon states, it's very different, but it falls into two blocks. There's one block that has nuclear weapons on high alert, ready to fly within, you know, short notice. And those are largely the nuclear weapon states that were heavily involved in the Cold War. So that's, you know, the United States, Russia, Britain and France. All other nuclear weapon states have not moved yet to alert nuclear forces. So not only do they have very much smaller arsenals, but they don't have them on very high alert or very high readiness. So they would have to go through a process of moving weapons out of storage and, you know, putting them on top of missiles and what have you before they could, you know, execute these things. It's very different with the United States and Russia. I mean, they have combined in the order of 1,800 nuclear warheads on missiles, within range, ready to fly. The U.S. ICBM force currently standing a little over 400 ICBMs. They're being reduced to 400. Those 400 ICBMs, they are ready to fly out of their silos in 4 minutes from the moment they receive the order from the president. And you want to look out around the world, and you're trying to see, what is it out there? that requires those weapons to be able to fly in 4 minutes. There is nothing, except one thing, other weapons on high alert. And there's a whole bunch of them over in Russia. And so those two countries are like, you know, two kids in a sandbox. They're basically holding each other's nuclear alert levels in check. One can't reduce because the other has, you know, that's the kind of mindset that really sort of a self-licking ice cream cone. I think that's the good one. So, but what's also interesting to see in those countries, it has changed. It's interesting to see that compared to the Cold War, I mean, we used to have in the order of 10,000 nuclear warheads loaded on delivery systems. We and the Russians, both. So, you know, things have changed. And what's also happened is that the bombers, for example, no longer on alert. They don't have weapons attached to them. You know, there are only a few, you know, relatively few nuclear weapons left at the bomber bases. Most of them have put into central storage, if you will. But they can be moved out and put back on the bombers within a few days. Tactical aircraft, they're also not on alert anymore, tactical nuclear weapons. They used to be standing in Europe on alert at the end of the runway with nuclear weapons strapped under their wings, ready to run out to the runway and take off. So a lot of things have changed, but we still hear people holding on to this, that for God knows what reason, we need to have nuclear weapons ready to fly on short notice. And the main reason we hear, because we've been talking a lot over the last couple of years with officials about this, the main argument they have is that, well, we feel threatened by nuclear weapons that can hit us on short notice, but if we took ours off alert, and even if the other side also took their side off their weapons off alert, if we then had a crisis and things got a little hot and dicey, and one of them was looking through their satellites and they saw that we were beginning to, you know, move our warheads out and load them back on the missiles, they would say, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, you guys start doing too." And then suddenly you would have this re-alerting race between the two countries about who can get up to a level where they feel safe or capable enough quickest. And that could create, they say, enormous instability in a crisis that might already be bad and sort of lead to worse things. So that's the main argument that today is being used. President Obama has bought into that argument. He ran for president with an explicit policy to seek to put an end to take nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert. That was the word he was using. As soon as he got in as president, you know, they dragged him into the war room and gave him the briefings, you know, and he drank the Kool-Aid, and that fell off the list. And now he has completed the nuclear posture review that concluded that we would continue the existing alert level of nuclear weapons. He has concluded issued the 2013 nuclear weapons employment guidance to the military for how does you plan for the potential use of nuclear weapons. That guidance reinforces and confirms the current alert status of nuclear forces. Complete sellout. Of course, to his justification, you know, he's somewhat squeezed in between a very, very conservative Congress that doesn't want to do anything that changes the current force posture, and a very non-cooperative Putin in the Kremlin, who has shown absolutely no interest in reducing alert levels, and in fact is even not interested in reducing nuclear force levels. He says, until after we have implemented the New START treaty, then we might talk. You know. So, status quo, not much is going on, and arguments that we don't find this argument that there could be a re-alerting race credible at all. We find it as a strawman argument, because even in our current alerted posture, most of our nuclear warheads are not deployed under the delivery systems. So if there were a crisis, it is in our military plans to increase the warhead loadings of the missiles. So we have re-alerting races built into our current nuclear posture already. That would happen. The Russians would see it, you know. So, you know, there are many easy arguments going around these days. Unfortunately, they're very much, it sounds to me at least, intended to sort of just prevent things from changing, to keep status quo going, you know, as long as you can. So, not very good arguments, but those are the kind of arguments we hear against de-alerting nuclear weapons.
Okay, thanks, Hans. So lots of work to do there, along with everything else.